And since we closed the box on our wedding night to now, our circumstances changed, our dreams changed, our expectations changed. But the most important thing between us never changed. We lost a lot of ourselves in this marriage, but we have never stopped loving each other. It's the one thing that stood strong against those Category 5 moments. I realize now that sometimes two people can lose their hope, or their desire, or their happiness, but losing all those things doesn't mean you've lost. We haven't lost yet, Quinn. And no matter what has happened since we closed this box, or what will happen after we open it, I promise to love you through it all. I promise to love you more when you're hurting than when you're happy. I promise to love you more when we're poor than when we're swimming in riches. I promise to love you more when you're crying than when you're laughing. I promise to love you more when you're sick than when you're healthy. I promise to love you more when you hate me than when you love me. I promise to love you more as a childless woman than I would love you as a mother. And I promise, I swear, that if you choose to end things between us, I will love you more as you're walking out the door than on the day you walked down the aisle. I hope you choose the road that will make you the happiest. Even if it's not a choice I'll love, I will still always love you, whether I'm a part of your life or not. You deserve happiness more than anyone I know. I love you. Forever. Graham. I don't know how long I cry after reading the final letter. Long enough that my head hurts and my stomach aches, and I've gone through half a box of Kleenex. I cry for so long I get lost in the grief. Graham is holding me. I don't know when he walked into the room, or when he knelt on the bed, or when he pulled me to his chest. He has no idea what I've even decided. He has no idea if the words about to come out of my mouth are going to be nice ones or hateful ones. Yet here he is, holding me as I cry, simply because it hurts him to see me cry. I press a kiss to his chest, right over his heart. And I don't know if it takes 5 minutes or half an hour, but when I finally stop crying long enough to speak, I lift my head from his chest and look at him. Graham, I whisper, I love you more in this moment than any moment that has come before it. As soon as the words are out of my mouth, the tears begin to fall from his eyes. Quinn, he says, holding my face. Quinn. It's all he can say. He's crying too hard to say anything else. He kisses me, and I kiss him back with everything in me, in an attempt to make up for all the kisses I denied him. I close my eyes, repeating the words from his letter that reached me the deepest. We haven't lost yet, Quinn. He's right. We might have finally given up at the same time, but that doesn't mean we can't get back that hope. I want to fight for him. I want to fight for him as hard as he's been fighting for me. I'm so sorry, Quinn, he whispers against my cheek. For everything. I shake my head, not even wanting an apology. But I know he needs my forgiveness, so I give it to him. I forgive you. With everything I am, Graham. I forgive you, and I don't blame you, and I am so sorry, too. Graham wraps his arms around me and holds me. We remain in the same position for so long, my tears have dried, but I'm still clinging to him with everything in me. And I'll do everything I can to make sure I never let go of him again. Chapter 29. Then. I couldn't imagine a better way to end our first anniversary. Wrapped up in a blanket outside, listening to the waves crash against the shore. It's the perfect moment for the perfect gift. I have something for you, I say to Graham. He's the one who usually surprises me with gifts, so the fact that I have one for him grabs his attention. He looks at me with anticipation and pulls the blanket away from me, pushing me out of the chair. I run inside and then return with his package. It's wrapped in Christmas paper, even though it's not even close to Christmas. It's all I could find, I say. I didn't have time to wrap it before I left, so I had to wrap it with what was in the closet here. He begins to open it, but before he even has the wrapping paper off, I blurt out, "It's a blanket." I made it.
He laughs. You are so terrible at surprises.
He pulls away the tissue paper and reveals the blanket I made out of ripped pieces of our clothing.
Are these?
He lifts up one of his ripped work shirts and laughs. We sometimes have issues with keeping our clothing intact when we're pulling them off each other. I think I've ripped a half dozen of Graham's shirts at least. Graham has ripped several of mine. Sometimes I do it because I love the dramatics of the buttons popping off. I don't remember when it started, but it's become a game to us. A pricey game, which is why I decided to put some of the discarded clothing to good use.
This is the best gift anyone has ever given me.
He throws the blanket over his shoulder and then picks me up. He carries me inside and lays me on the bed. He rips my nightgown off of me, and then he rips his own shirt for show. The whole scene has me laughing until he climbs on top of me and smothers my laugh with his tongue. Graham lifts my knee and starts to push himself inside me, but I press against his chest. We need a condom, I whisper breathlessly. I was on antibiotics last week for a cold I was trying to get over, so I haven't been taking my pill. We've had to use condoms all week as a preventative measure. Graham rolls off me and walks to his duffel bag. He grabs a condom, but he doesn't immediately come back to the bed. He just stares at it. Then he tosses it back onto the bag. What are you doing? With a heavy amount of assuredness, he says,
I don't want to use one tonight. I don't respond.
He doesn't want to use a condom? Am I reading his intent wrong? Graham walks back to the bed and lowers himself on top of me again. He kisses me, then pulls back.
I think about it sometimes. About you getting pregnant.
You do? I was not expecting that. I hesitate a moment before saying, just because you think about it doesn't mean you're ready for it.
But I am. When I think about it, I get excited.
He rolls onto his side and puts his hand on my stomach.
I don't think you should get back on the pill.
I grip the top of his hand, shocked at how much I want to kiss him and laugh and take him inside me. But as sure as I am about having children, I don't want to make that choice unless he's just as certain as I am.
Are you positive?
The thought of us becoming parents fills me with an overwhelming amount of love for him. So much, I feel a tear fall down my cheek. Graham sees the tear, and he smiles as he brushes it away with his thumb.
I love that you love me so much it sometimes makes you cry. And I love that the idea of us having a baby makes you cry. I love how full of love you are, Quinn.
He kisses me. I don't think I tell him enough what a great kisser he is. He's the best I've ever had. I don't know what makes his kisses different from the men I've kissed in the past, but it's so much better. Sometimes I'm scared he'll get tired of kissing me someday because of how much I kiss him. I just can't be near him without tasting him. You're a really good kisser, I whisper. Graham laughs.
Only because it's you I'm kissing.
We kiss even more than we usually do when we make love. And I know we've made love 100 times before tonight. Maybe even 1,000 times. But this time feels different. It's the first time we don't have some kind of barrier preventing us from creating a new life together. It's like we're making love with a purpose. Graham finishes inside of me, and it's the most incredible feeling, knowing that our love for each other might be creating something even bigger than our love for each other. I don't know how that can even be possible. How can I possibly love anyone as much or even more than I love Graham? It's been such a perfect day. I've experienced a lot of perfect moments, but entire perfect days are hard to come by. You need the perfect weather, the perfect company, the perfect food, the perfect itinerary, the perfect mood. I wonder if things will always be this perfect. Now that we've decided to start a family, part of me wonders if there's a level of perfection that we haven't even reached yet. What will things be like next year when we're possibly parents? Or 5 years from now? 10? Sometimes I wish I had a crystal ball that could actually see into the future. I'd want to know everything. I'm tracing my fingers in an invisible pattern over his chest when I look up at him. Where do you think we'll be 10 years from now?
Graham smiles. He loves talking about the future.
Hopefully we'll have our own house in 10 years, he says. Not too big, not too small. But the yard will be huge, and we'll play outside with the kids all the time. We'll have two, a boy and a girl, and you'll be pregnant with the third.
I smile at that thought. He reacts to the smile on my face, and he continues to talk.
You'll still write,
but you'll work from home, and you'll only work when you feel like it. I'll own my own accounting firm.
You'll drive a minivan because we're totally going to be those parents who take the kids to soccer games and gymnastics.
Graham grins at me.
And we'll make love all the time. Probably not as often as we do now, but more than all of our friends.
I press my hand over his heart. That sounds like the perfect life, Graham.
Because it does. But any life with Graham sounds perfect.
Or, he adds,
maybe nothing will change. Maybe we'll still live in an apartment. Maybe we'll be struggling financially because we keep moving from job to job. We might not even be able to have kids, so we won't have a big yard or even a minivan. We'll be driving our same shitty cars 10 years from now.
Maybe absolutely nothing will change, and 10 years from now, our lives will be the same as they are now. And all we'll have is each other. Just like after he described the first scenario, a serene smile spreads across my face. That sounds like the perfect life, too.
And it does. As long as I have Graham, I don't know that this life could be anything less than what it is now. And right now, it's wonderful.
I relax against his chest and fall asleep with the most peaceful feeling in my heart.
Chapter 30
Now
Quinn.
His voice is raspy against my ear. It's the first morning in a long time that I've been able to wake up with a smile on my face. I open my eyes, and Graham looks like a completely different person than the broken man who walked through Ava and Reed's front door last night. He presses his lips to my cheek, and then pulls back, pushing my hair off my face.
What did I miss while you were sleeping?
I've missed those words so much. It's one of the things I've missed the most about us. It means even more to me now, knowing he only stopped asking me because he didn't want me to hurt. I reach my hand out to his face and brush my thumb across his mouth. I dreamt about us. He kisses the pad of my thumb.
Was it a good dream or a bad dream?
It was good, I say. It wasn't a typical weird dream, though. It was more of a memory. Graham slips a hand between his head and the pillow.
I want to know every detail.
I mirror his position, smiling when I begin telling him about the dream. It was our first anniversary, the night we decided to start a family. I asked you where you thought we'd be 10 years from now. Do you remember? Graham shakes his head.
Vaguely. Where did I think we'd be?
You said we'd have kids, and I'd drive a minivan, and we'd live in a house with a big yard where we played with our children. Graham's smile falters. I brush his frown away with my thumb, wanting his smile back. It's strange, because I forgot all about that conversation until I dreamt about it last night. But it didn't make me sad, Graham, because then you said we might not have any of that. You said there was a chance that we'd be moving from job to job, and that we wouldn't be able to have kids, and that maybe nothing between us would change after 10 years, and all we'd have was each other.
I remember that,
he whispers. Do you remember what I said to you? He shakes his head. I said, that sounds like the perfect life, too. Graham blows out a breath, like he's been waiting a lifetime for the words I'm giving him. I'm sorry I lost sight of that, I whisper. Of us. You've always been enough for me. Always. He looks at me like he's missed my dreams as much as he's missed me.
I love you, Quinn.
I love you, too. He presses his lips to my forehead, then my nose. I kiss him on the chin, and we lie snuggled together.
at least until the moment is ruined by the growl from my stomach.
Does your sister have anything to eat around here?
Gram pulls me out of the bed and we quietly make our way to the kitchen. It's not even 8 in the morning yet, and Ava and Reed are still asleep. Gram and I scour the kitchen for all the food we need to make pancakes and eggs. He turns on the stove, and I'm mixing the batter when I notice the wooden box he made me still sitting at the end of the counter. I put down the mixer and walk over to the box. I run my hand over it, wondering if things would be different today had he not made this gift for us to close on our wedding night. I still remember writing him the love letter. I also remember slipping the nude pic inside the envelope. I wonder how different I look now than when I snapped that picture. I open the box to pull out his letter, but when I pick it up, I notice a few scraps of paper at the bottom of the box. One of them is the yellow post-it note I left stuck to my wall for 6 months. The other two are our fortunes. I pick them up and read them. I can't believe you kept these all this time. It's so cute. Graham walks over to me.
Cute?
He pulls one of the fortunes out of my hands. This isn't cute. It's proof that fate exists. I shake my head and point to his fortune. Your fortune says you would succeed in a business endeavor that day, but you didn't even go to work. How is that proof that we're soulmates?
His lips curl up into a grin. If I had been at work, I never would have met you, Quinn. I'd say that's the biggest work-related success I've ever had.
I tilt my head, wondering why I never thought of his fortune from that point of view.
Also, there's this.
Graham flips his fortune over and holds it up, pointing at the number 8 on the back. I look down and also read the number on the back of mine. An 8. 2 number 8s. The date we reconnected all those years ago.
You lied to me, I say, looking back up at him. You said you were kidding about these having 8s on the back.
Graham takes the fortune out of my hand and carefully places both of them back in the box.
I didn't want you to fall in love with me because of fate, he says, closing the box. I wanted you to fall in love with me simply because you couldn't help yourself.
I smile as I stare up at him with appreciation. I love that he's sentimental. I love that he believes in fate more than he believes in coincidences. I love that he believes I'm his fate. I stand on the tips of my toes and kiss him. He grabs the back of my head with both hands and returns my kiss with just as much appreciation. After several moments of kissing and a couple of failed efforts at stopping, he mutters something about the pancakes burning and forces himself away from me as he steps to the stove. I bring my fingers to my lips and smile when I realize he just kissed me and I had absolutely no desire to pull away from him. In fact, I wanted the kiss to last even longer than it did. It's a feeling I wasn't sure I would be capable of again. I debate pulling him back to me because I really want to kiss him again. But I also really want pancakes, so I let him resume cooking. I turn toward the wooden box and reach for the letter I wrote to him. Now that I feel like we're on a path to recovery, it makes me want to read the words I wrote to him when we were first starting this journey together. I flip over the envelope to pull out the letter, but the envelope is still sealed.
Graham?
I turn back around.
You didn't read yours?
Graham glances over his shoulder and smiles at me.
I didn't need to, Quinn. I'll read it on our 25th anniversary.
He faces the stove and resumes cooking, like he didn't just say something that feels more healing than anything he's ever said or done. I look back down at the letter with a smile on my face. Even with the temptation of nude pictures, he was secure enough in his love for me that he didn't need any reassurance from reading this letter. I suddenly want to write him another letter to go along with this one. In fact, I might even start doing what he's been doing all these years and add more letters to the box. I want to write him so many letters that when we finally reopen this box for the right reasons, he'll have enough letters to read for a week.
Where do you think we'll be on our 25th anniversary? I ask.
Together, he says, matter of fact.
Do you think we'll ever leave Connecticut?
He faces me.
Do you want to?
I shrug. Maybe.
I think about it sometimes, he admits. I've already got a few personal clients lined up. If I secured a few more,
It would allow for that, but it probably wouldn't pay as much. But we could travel for a year or two, maybe longer if we enjoy it enough.
This conversation reminds me of the night I spoke to my mother on the steps outside of her home. I don't think I give her enough credit, but she's right. I can spend my time focusing on the perfect version of the life I'll never have, or I can spend my time enjoying the life I do have. And the life I have would provide me with so much opportunity if I would get out of my own head long enough to chase those opportunities. I used to want to be so many things before I became obsessed with the idea of being a mother. Graham smiles sweetly at me.
I remember. You wanted to write a book.
It's been so long since I've talked about it, I'm surprised he remembers.
I did. I still do.
He's smiling at me when he turns to flip the rest of the pancakes.
What else do you want to do, besides write a book?
I move to stand next to him near the stove. He wraps one arm around me while he cooks with his other hand. I rest my head against his shoulder. I want to see the world, I say quietly, and I would really like to learn a new language.
Maybe we should move here to Italy and piggyback off Ava's language tutor.
I laugh at his comment, but Graham sets down the spatula and faces me with an excited gleam in his eyes. He leans against the counter.
Let's do it. Let's move here. We have nothing tying us down.
I tilt my head and eye him. Are you serious?
It would be fun to try something new. And it doesn't even have to be Italy. We can move anywhere you want.
My heart begins to beat faster with the anticipation of doing something that insane and spontaneous. I do really like it here, I say. A lot. And I miss Ava. Graham nods.
Yeah, I kind of miss Reed. But don't repeat that.
I push myself up onto the counter next to the stove. Last week, I went for a walk and saw a cottage a few streets over for rent. We could try it out temporarily. Graham looks at me like he's in love with the idea. Or maybe he's looking at me like he's in love with me.
Let's go look at it today.
Okay, I say, full of giddiness. I catch myself biting my cheek in an attempt to hide my smile, but I immediately stop trying to hide it. If there's one thing Graham deserves, it's for my happiness to be transparent. And this moment is the first moment in a long time I've felt this much happiness. I want him to feel it, too. It's like this is the first time I've truly felt like I might be okay, that we'll be okay. It's the first time I don't look at him and feel guilty for everything I can't give him, because I know how grateful he is for everything I can give him.
Thank you, I whisper, for everything you said in your letters.
He stands between my legs, placing his hands on my hips. I wrap my arms around his neck, and for the first time in a long time, I kiss my husband and feel full of gratitude. I know my life as a whole hasn't been perfect, but I'm finally starting to appreciate all the perfect things within it. There are so many of them. My flexible job, my husband, my in-laws, my sister, my nieces, my nephew. That thought makes me pause. I pull back and look up at Graham. What did my fortune say? Do you have it memorized?
If you only shine light on your flaws, all your perfects will dim.
I think about it for a moment, about how fitting that fortune is for my life. I've spent way too much time putting all of my focus on my infertility. So much so, my husband and all the other things that are perfect in my life were being forced to take a back seat. Since the moment we cracked open those fortune cookies, I've never really taken them seriously. But maybe Graham is right. Maybe those fortunes are more than a coincidence, and maybe Graham was right about the existence of fate. If so, I think my fate is standing right in front of me. Graham touches my mouth with the tips of his fingers and slowly traces the smile on my lips.
You have no idea what this smile means to me, Quinn. I've missed it so much.
Epilogue. Wait, look at this one. I pull on Graham's hand, making him stop in his tracks on the sidewalk again. But I can't help it.
Almost every store on this street has the cutest children's clothes I've ever seen, and Max would be adorable in the outfit displayed in the window. Graham tries to keep moving forward, but I pull on his hand until he relents and follows me into the store.
"We were almost to the car," he says. "So close."
I shove the bags of kids' clothes I've already bought into Graham's hands, and then find the rack with the toddler sizes. "Should I get the green pants or the yellow ones?" I hold them up to Graham, and he says, "Definitely yellow." The green pants are cuter, but I go with Graham's choice simply because he volunteered an answer. He hates shopping for clothes, and this is only the 9th store I've forced him to follow me into. I swear this is the last one. Then we can go home. I give Graham a quick peck on the lips before walking to the register. Graham follows me and pulls his wallet out of his pocket.
"You know I don't care, Quinn. Shop all day if you want. He only turns 2 once."
I hand the clothes to the cashier. In a thick Italian accent, she says,
"This outfit is my absolute favorite."
She looks up at us and says,
"How old is your little boy?"
"He's our nephew. Tomorrow is his 2nd birthday."
"Ah, perfect," she says. "Would you like this in a gift box?"
"No, a bag is fine." She tells Graham the total, and as he's paying, the cashier looks at me again.
"What about the two of you? Any children of your own?"
I smile at her and open my mouth, but Graham beats me to the punch.
"We have 6 children," he lies, "but they're all grown now and out of the house."
I try not to laugh, but once we decided to start lying to strangers about our infertility, it's become a competition with who can be the most ridiculous. Graham usually wins. Last week, he told a lady we had quadruplets. Now he's trying to convince someone that a couple our age could have 6 children already grown and out of our home. "All girls," I add. "We kept trying for a boy, but it just wasn't in the cards." The cashier's mouth falls open.
"You have 6 daughters?"
Graham takes the bag and the receipt from her.
"Yes, and 2 granddaughters."
He always takes it a little too far. I grab Graham's hand and mutter a thank you to the cashier, pulling him outside as fast as I pulled him inside. When we're on the sidewalk again, I slap him on the arm.
"You are so ridiculous," I say, laughing.
He threads our fingers together as we begin to walk.
"We should make up names for our imaginary daughters," he says, "in case someone probes for details."
We're passing a kitchen store when he says this, and my eyes automatically fall on a spice rack in the window. "Coriander," I tell him. "She's the oldest." Graham pauses and looks at the spice rack with me.
"Parsley is the youngest, and paprika and cinnamon are the oldest set of twins."
I laugh. "We have 2 sets of twins?"
"Juniper and saffron."
As we're heading toward our car, I say, "Okay, let me make sure I have this right. In order of birth, coriander, paprika, cinnamon, juniper, saffron, and parsley." Graham smiles.
"Almost. Saffron was born 2 minutes before juniper."
I roll my eyes, and he squeezes my hand as we cross the street together. It still amazes me how much has changed since we opened the box 2 years ago. We came so close to losing everything we had built together because of something that was out of our control. Something that should have brought us closer together, but instead pulled us further apart. Avoidance sounds like such a harmless word, but that one word can cause some severe damage to a relationship. We avoided so much in our marriage, simply out of fear. We avoided communicating. We avoided talking about the challenges we faced. We avoided all the things that made us the saddest. And after time, I began to avoid the other half of my life altogether. I avoided him physically, which led to emotional avoidance, which led to a lot of feelings that were left unsaid. Opening that box made me realize that our marriage wasn't in need of a minor repair. It needed to be rebuilt from the ground up with an entirely different foundation. I started out our life together with certain expectations, and when those expectations weren't met, I had no idea how to move forward. But Graham has been the constant fighting force behind my healing. I finally stopped being as sad about our fate. I stopped focusing on what we would never have together and started focusing on all the things we did have and could have. It didn't eliminate my pain altogether, but I'm happier than I've been in a very long time. Of course, opening the box didn't miraculously solve everything. It didn't immediately take away my desire for children, although it did increase my lust for a life outside of being a mother. It didn't completely dissolve my aversion to sex, although it did open the door to slowly learning how to separate the sex from the hope from the devastation. And I occasionally still cry in the shower, but I never cry alone. I cry while Graham holds me, because he made me promise I would stop trying to hide the brunt of my heartache. I no longer hide it. I embrace it. I'm learning how to wear my struggle as a badge and not be ashamed of it. I'm learning to not be so personally offended by other people's ignorance in relation to infertility. And part of what I've learned is that I have to have a sense of humor about it all. I never thought I would be at a point where we could turn all the painful questions into a game. Now when we're out in public, I actually look forward to when someone asks if we have kids, because I know Graham is going to say something that will make me laugh. I've also learned that it's okay to have a little hope. For so long, I was so worn down and emotionally exhausted that I thought if I figured out a way to lose all hope, I would also lose all expectation and all disappointment. But it didn't work that way. The hope has been the only positive thing about being infertile. I will never lose hope that we might actually have a child of our own. I still apply to adoption agencies and talk to lawyers. I don't know that we'll ever stop trying to make it happen. But I've learned that even though I'm still hoping to become a mother, it doesn't mean I can't live a fulfilling life while I continue to try. For once, I'm happy, and I know that I'll be happy 20 years from now, even if it's still just me and Graham.
Shit, Graham mutters as we reach our car. He points at the tire. We have a flat.
I glance at the car, and the tire is definitely flat. So flat, no amount of air could salvage it. Do we have a spare? We're in Graham's car, so he opens the trunk and lifts the floor portion, revealing a spare and a jack.
Thank God, he says.
I put our bags in the back seat of the car and watch as he pulls out the tire and the jack. Luckily, the flat is on the passenger side, which is flush with the sidewalk, rather than the road. Graham rolls the tire near the flat one and then moves the jack. He looks up at me with an embarrassed look on his face.
Quinn.
He kicks at a pebble on the sidewalk, breaking eye contact with me. I laugh, because I can tell by his embarrassment that he has no idea what to do next. Graham Wells, have you never changed a flat tire?
He shrugs. I'm sure I could Google it. But you mentioned to me once that Ethan never let you change a flat.
He motions toward the tire.
I'm giving you first dibs.
I grin. I'm loving this way too much. Put the parking brake on. Graham sets the parking brake while I position the jack under the car and begin to raise it.
This is kind of hot,
Graham says, leaning against a light pole as he watches me. I grab the wrench and begin removing the lug nuts from the tires. We're on a busy sidewalk, so two people stop to ask if they can help because they don't realize Graham is with me. Both times Graham says,
thank you, but my wife has got this.
I laugh when I realize what he's doing. The entire time I'm changing the tire, Graham brags about it to everyone who walks by.
Look, my wife knows how to change a tire.
When I finally finish, he puts the jack and the flat tire back in the trunk. My hands are covered in grease. I'm going to run inside this store and wash my hands. Graham nods and opens the driver's side door while I rush into the nearest store. When I walk inside, I'm taken off guard as I look around. I was expecting this to be another clothing store, but it isn't. There are pet crates displayed in the window, and a bird, a parakeet, perched on top of a cage near the front door.
Chow, the bird says loudly.
I raise an eyebrow. Hello.
Chow, it screeches again. Chow, chow.
That's the only word he knows, a lady says as she approaches me. You here to adopt, or are you here for supplies? I hold up my greasy hands. Neither. I'm hoping you have a sink. The woman points me in the direction of the restroom. I make my way through the store, pausing to look at all the various animals in their cages. There are rabbits and turtles and kittens and guinea pigs. But when I make it to the back of the store, near the restroom, I pause in my tracks and suck in a breath. I stare at him for a moment, because he's staring right back at me. Two big brown eyes, looking at me like I'm the 50th person to walk past him today. But he still somehow has hope in those eyes, like maybe I'll be the first one to actually consider adopting him. I step closer to his cage, which is flanked by several empty cages. He's the only dog in the whole store. Hey, buddy, I whisper. I read the note at the bottom left corner of his cage. Beneath the Italian description is a description written in English. German Shepherd, male, 7 weeks old, available for adoption. I stare at the note for a moment, and then force myself to walk to the bathroom. I scrub my hands as fast as I can, because I can't stand for that puppy to think I'm just another one of the dozens of people who walked past him today and didn't want to take him home. I've never been much of a dog person, because I've never had a dog before. I honestly thought I'd never own a dog, but I have a feeling I'm not walking out of this store without this puppy. Before I leave the bathroom, I pull my phone from my pocket and shoot Graham a text. Come inside to the back of the store. Hurry. I walk out of the bathroom, and when the puppy sees me again, his ears perk up. He lifts a paw and presses it against the cage as I come closer. He's sitting on his hind legs, but I can see his tail twitching, like he wants my attention, but he's scared it'll just be fleeting and he'll be spending another night in this cage. I slip my fingers between the bars of his cage, and he sniffs them, then licks me. I feel a tightening in my chest every time we make eye contact, because seeing him so full of hope, but so scared of disappointment, makes me sad. This puppy reminds me of me, of how I used to feel. I hear someone walking up behind me, so I spin around to see Graham staring at the puppy. He walks up to the cage and tilts his head. The puppy looks from me to Graham, and then finally stands up, unable to stop his tail from wagging. I don't even have to say anything. Graham just nods his head and says, "Hey, little guy, you want to come home with us?"
It's been 3 days, Ava says. That poor puppy needs a name.
She's clearing off the table, preparing to go home. Reed left with Max about an hour ago to put him to bed. We all try to eat dinner together a few times a week, but we usually go to their house, since Max goes to bed early. But now we're the ones with a new baby, and even though that new baby is a puppy, he naps and pees and poops as much as a human newborn.
It's so hard coming up with a good name, though, I groan. I want to give him a name that'll mean something, but we've tossed out every idea we've had. You're being too picky.
It took you 8 months to choose a name for your child. 3 days isn't that long for a dog. Ava shrugs. Good point. She wipes down the table as I cover the leftover food and put it in the fridge. I thought about giving him a math-related name, since Graham loves math so much. Like maybe naming him after a number? Ava laughs.
It's so weird that you say that. I just got my files at work today for the high school foreign exchange students I'll be tutoring when they arrive in a couple of weeks. One of them is a girl from Texas. Her birth name is Seven Marie Jacobs, but she goes by Six. I thought of Graham when I saw that.
Why does she go by Six if her birth name is Seven? Ava shakes her head.
I don't know, but it's quirky. I haven't even met her yet, but I already like the girl.
Ava pauses and looks up at me.
What about naming it after one of the characters in your book?
I shake my head. Already thought of that, but those characters feel like actual people now that the book is finished. I know it's weird, but I want the dog to have his own name. I'd feel like he was being forced to share.
Makes sense, Ava says, resting her hands on her hips. Any news from your agent?
She hasn't submitted to publishers yet,
It's being reviewed by an in-house editor, and then they're going to try and sell it.
Ava smiles. I hope it happens, Quinn. I'm going to freak the fuck out if I walk into a bookstore and see your book on the shelf.
You and me both.
Graham walks inside with the puppy, and Ava meets him at the door.
It's late. I gotta go, she says, talking to the puppy while scratching him on his head. I hope when I see you tomorrow, you have a name.
Graham and I tell her goodbye, and he locks the door behind her. He cradles the puppy in his arms and walks over to me.
Guess who used the bathroom twice, so his mommy and daddy can get a few hours of sleep?
I pull the puppy out of Graham's arms and squeeze him. He licks my cheek, and then rests his head in the crease of my elbow. He's tired.
I'm tired too, Graham says, yawning.
I put the puppy into his crate and cover it with a blanket. Neither of us knows anything about dogs, so we've been reading as much as we possibly can about how to crate train them, what they eat, how they should be disciplined, how much they should sleep. Sleep has definitely been the most difficult thing to tackle so far. Being the owner of a new puppy comes with new hurdles, but the biggest of those hurdles is exhaustion. I wouldn't trade it for anything, though. Every time that little puppy looks at me, I melt. Graham and I make our way to the bedroom. We leave our door open so we can hear the puppy if he starts to cry. When we crawl into bed, I roll toward Graham and rest my head on his chest.
I can't imagine what having a newborn must be like if a puppy is this tiring, I say.
You're forgetting about all our sleepless nights with coriander, paprika, cinnamon, saffron, juniper, and parsley.
I laugh. I love you.
I love you too.
I curl even more into Graham, and he tightens his hold around me. I do my best to fall asleep, but my mind keeps running through potential puppy names until I'm positive I've exhausted every name in existence.
Quinn.
Graham's voice is against my ear, warm and quiet.
Quinn, wake up.
I open my eyes and pull away from his chest. He points behind me and says,
Look.
I half turn and glance over at the alarm clock, right as it changes to midnight. Graham leans into my ear and whispers,
It's the 8th of August. 10 years later, and we're happily married. I told you so.
I sigh. Why am I not surprised that you remembered that? I don't know how I didn't expect this moment. The number 8 holds so much meaning to us that the date should have been obvious to me, but I've been so preoccupied with the puppy the last few days, I didn't even realize today was the 8th of August.
August, I whisper. That's what we'll name the puppy.
All Your Perfects, a novel, was written by Colleen Hoover and read by Madeline Mabee. Editing and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. All Your Perfects, a novel, is available in print from Atria. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Without Merit, a novel by Colleen Hoover, read by Candace Thaxton.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.